Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
Well, and I think that is so much the only difference between me and probably everybody else, and I don't mean it that way. I know egotistically or immodestly, but it is why I got to 90s. It's why I have a permanent place in the Smithsonian. It's why I've won all of the awards I've ever won. It's why everything has happened. I believe I can. I absolutely believe I can. I have enough confidence in me that no matter what the challenge, no matter what the obstacle, no matter what the odds, no matter what the statistics, no matter who is telling me no, that doesn't matter if I believe I can. And when I believe I can, that's the only tool I need in my toolbox to get me from where I'm at to where I want to go. And it works every single swing in time.
Hi, this is Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Here's my very first interview with someone who has actually been a billionaire. That's with a B, not an M. This is an interview with a gentleman named Bill Bartman. It is the ultimate rags-to-riches, back-to-rags, and back-to-riches story you'll ever hear. You'll hear how this once billionaire overcame personal circumstances and tragedy to raise to the top of corporate America. Homeless at age 14, he joined a traveling carnival and then to a member of a street gang to a high school dropout. He took control of his life by taking the GED exam and putting himself through college and law school. Bill then took over a foreclosed oil-filled pipe manufacturing plant and turned it into $1 million a month business in less than 1 year, until OPEC slashed the price of oil, leaving Bill out of a business and $1 million in the hole. Bill refused to give up and filed personal bankruptcy. He then borrowed $13,000 and created an entire new industry, debt resolution. 3 years later, they had repaid the entire $1 million debt. Over the next 13 years, they grew this company to 3,900 employees with revenues in excess of $1 billion and earnings in excess of $182 million. There, Bill pioneered novel financial instruments still utilized today on Wall Street. Bill also implemented unheard-of perks and benefits for their employees, such as salaries at twice the normal industry rates. Bill and his wife, Kathy, have individually graced the covers of national business magazines, Kathy on the cover of Forbes and Bill on the cover of Inc. They were listed individually in the Forbes 400 Wealthiest People in America. One national magazine ranked them number 25. Bill may be the only high school dropout who has had Harvard Business School use him as a case study, has been granted a permanent place in the Smithsonian Institution Museum of American History, has been included in Forbes magazine list of the 400 wealthiest Americans, named as one of the top 100 entrepreneurs of the last 100 years by the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership, AllBusiness.com, and Apple Computer, had his management techniques published in college textbooks and taught at universities across America, lauded by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas for his Minority Enterprise Initiative, acknowledged by Business Week as one of the top 10 family-oriented businesses in America, acknowledged by the Working Woman magazine as one of the top 100 best, appointed by the governor of Oklahoma to a 4-year term on the board of Oklahoma Futures. In 1998, tragedy struck when Bill's former business partner committed fraud and sent the company into a bankruptcy. The U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft indicted Bill on 57 felony counts relating to Bill's partner's activities. This could have landed him in jail for over 700 years. 5 years later, after a 2.5 month long trial where the government called 53 witnesses and produced over 1,000 exhibits, Bill rested his case without calling a single witness or producing a single exhibit. The jury unanimously acquitted Bill on all counts. Ironically, 17 months after his acquittal and 6.5 years after his company was liquidated, the federal bankruptcy trustee issued his report, which publicly acknowledged for the first time Bill's company, CFS, was not a fraud. This experience would have embittered most people, but not Bill. Bill now travels the country sharing his story of how he created his success and how he dealt with these challenges. It is his life goal to do for failure what Betty Ford did for alcoholism and what Susan Kaufman did for breast cancer. So get ready for this 2-hour interview. We cover a lot of information, and I hope you find this story as riveting as I did. Enjoy. For more free reports, products, and services from Bill Bartman, go to www.billionairebubba.com. That's www.billionairebubba.com. Do you have 5 big mistakes that businesses should definitely not make?
Certainly do, Michael, and you have some familiarity with me, and I tell my audiences that these 5 things cost me $700 million apiece, each of them, so it's a $3.5 billion loss. Rule number one, or lesson number one, is to never let your company pay your personal expenses. Most of us in the business world, when we are the sole proprietor or the general partner or we own the corporation, whatever vehicle you happen to use for your entity, you know, it's really our money as we think about it, but it's like we don't think it much matters whether it's the right hand or the left hand or the right pocket or the left pocket. But in the reality of the world, it can make a great big difference, and it made a great big difference in my life. I had a subchapter S corporation that I allowed to pay my taxes, and though that is perfectly legal, perfectly copacetic, well documented, well notified to the whole of the world, the end of the days when my company got in trouble, the trustee in bankruptcy was able to set aside the very contract that authorized that transaction, which made it an unauthorized transaction. And that allowed him then to sue me to recover all of the money my company had paid on my behalf, which is the sum of $20 million. It was more than the liquidity I had available, and it literally caused Kathy and I to go into bankruptcy. So rule number one is never let your company pay your personal expenses. I don't care if it's credit card receipts or parking tickets or lunch or otherwise. Keep your bookkeeping separate. Rule number two, never, ever expect your high-priced management to stay alongside of you during a moment of crisis. Now, I'm not speaking ill of people, and I'm not throwing stones or trying to suggest that mankind is bad. Quite the opposite. I'm a strong believer and a very, very strong proponent in believing that people are good. People are inherently good. But no matter how good they are, never expect somebody to be inconsistent or incongruent with their basic nature. And the basic nature of a person, you and me and every other person, is to take care of their own family before they take care of somebody else's family. So when a calamity occurs inside an organization and the CEO expects all of his senior managers and senior executives to stand alongside of him, each and every one of them have to ask and answer their own question. Well, standing alongside of my CEO, maybe my former CEO, will that put my own family in jeopardy? And if it won't, then of course I'll stand next to him. Then he's my friend. He's my mentor. He's a person who has been with me all these years and has guided me and rewarded me and paid me, and they have 1,000 reasons to like you. But if the answer comes back different on the very first question of, will this put my own family in jeopardy, then all those other things pale in comparison. They no longer matter, and that employee will not do anything, nor should they ever do anything, inconsistent with protecting their family before they protect your family. Now, the value in for that to you, whomever's listening to this, is if you know that, if you recognize that and you're aware of that, that doesn't mean you have to think ill of your employees. You just have to be cognizant that if the stuff ever hits the fan, they will probably protect themselves and their family before they will protect you and your family. Knowing that little difference then allows you to react accordingly. Number three, always, always diversify your financial assets. And again, in the private arena, the privately held company arena, most people don't. We start from the back pocket to create our company, and as the company grows, we own it and we run it, and we're the chief cook and the bottle washer, and we tend to pour back the profits into the company. And while that's a wonderful thing to do in order to help the company grow and to take it to the next level, frequently we have ended up in a situation where everything we own is buried inside of that company, where everything is in one jar, so to speak, and if anything bad were to happen to your company, then quite frankly, you don't just lose the company. You may lose everything, everything in your personal life as well. And point number four, never, never surrender the high ground. And the high ground is a moral, ethical, legal high ground. And those are really three different places to stand. There's the moral, which we all understand. There's the ethical, which is slightly different than moral. And then there's even the legal. And the legal is kind of the last mantra of a person who has suffered and learned some things. Always hire a management consultant before the crisis. We hire accountants and lawyers and other people to help us during our day-to-day operation of a company, but rarely do we ever hire a crisis manager or a crisis consultant until there's actually a crisis on hand. And you say, well, you really don't need one until there's a crisis. No, no, I think sometimes it can be preventive. If you had one of those in early, before there's even something on the table, they might have uncovered some things that could have avoided the whole of the issue. So frequently, crisis management can be a wonderful preventive technique rather than just a triage after a calamity.
So all of these lessons, if you had these in place before what happened to you, do you think you could have avoided all of this pain, I would say?
Yeah, I really do. I think any one of the five would have avoided it. So it's probably a stretch on number two on the management because that wouldn't be that controlling. But in terms of the others, you know, I think the other four were so powerful in and of themselves. If I had had just any one of them, I think we could have avoided it.
After listening to what you went through, and I want to get into this, I mean, you have amazing tenacity and resilience, and I hope your stress level, I'm sure, is a little lower now these days.
I am so at peace with myself, Michael, and it's such a wonderful thing, and I think, you know, it's that old thing of adversity introduces you to yourself, and we will only know what we're capable of by the experiences we've had. We can't imagine how we will react under a stressful, traumatic environment in which we can't imagine it accurately. Until it actually occurs. And once it does, you then know what it is you're capable of handling. It's that old Nietzsche thing, that which does not destroy me makes me stronger. And having gone through some pretty significant things in the course of my life, over the course of my entire life, I have this peace and comfort that there's just not a lot out there that can really hurt you if you have the right attitude.
That's right. How old are you now?
I'm 58.
And you are one of eight children?
That is correct.
And what did your mom and dad do?
I'm one of eight kids, and my mom cleaned other people's houses for a living. My dad is a janitor, and they both are really honorable, hardworking people that work essentially every single day of their life. But the bad news is, in the jobs they had, they didn't make enough money to feed all 10 of us. So we got by on handouts from Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, welfare, and things of that sort. I remember almost every holiday, the Salvation Army people would show up at our doorstep with one of those food baskets. And though you welcomed it and wanted it and really appreciated getting it, you know, there's something that kind of sticks in your craw about living off the charity.
When did you know you were poor?
I think we knew it all along. I mean, some people express it differently, and I know some people say, gee, we didn't know we were poor because everybody in the neighborhood is poor. I think you know when you're getting charity. And we got charity. And when you knew that your parents couldn't buy you the things that other kids in the neighborhood had, or they couldn't buy you things you knew you needed, it wasn't things you wanted, it was like buying you a bicycle. It was talking about clothing and food. And when they couldn't afford to do that on a regular enough basis, please don't make it sound like mom and dad were bad people. They weren't.
No, not at all.
They were working as hard as they could to do what they could. They just didn't have very many tools to do it with.
And they had eight kids. Did your parents stay together?
They did. They are now both deceased, but they stayed together for 52 years.
Were you one of the youngest?
No, I was third from the bottom. There were five on top of me, as we would say. I had five sisters and two brothers. So four of the girls were older than me, and one of the brothers was older than me.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. And so you moved around a lot.
We did. We moved in and out of eight different rent houses by the time I was 14 years old. Again, in that economic strata that we were in, owning a house was not even in, within the realm of comprehension. So we moved in and out of rent houses, and because we were relatively poor, and I think that's probably an understatement, the rent houses we lived in weren't the nice rent houses. They were some of the really, really not so nice ones. Some of the rent houses we lived in didn't have indoor plumbing. two of them we actually got evicted from by the city because the city said they weren't fit for human habitation. And, you know, when a city comes and puts a red posting, and I can still remember it. I was a child, but I can still remember when they put these red banners on the door, notices that tell you and the rest of the world that this building is unfit for human habitation. Now, you know, in our neighborhood, we didn't have a dog for a pet. In our neighborhood, a dog was thought of as a survival tool because a really good dog will keep the rats off you at night. And though that may sound harsh and cold, that was the world we lived in.
Was it a loving environment, or was it pretty chaotic with the family?
No, honestly, it was mostly dysfunctional and never abusive, never, you know, mean and nasty. It wasn't any of that mommy dearest kind of thing of beating you with a coat hanger, and there was no sexual abuse or any of that kind of stuff. I think mom and dad, bless their heart, just didn't know how to love. And I don't think they knew how to, and they never raised their hand or their voice at us. They did the best they could with what they had, but I don't remember ever having a birthday party.
Yeah. So growing up poor, I mean, you tell me, was this the seed for that desire to really, you know, succeed, that struggle? Do you think that was the seed and really giving you the drive to succeed?
I think it was the germ of the seed. There's some more things that happened to me in my youth than thereafter that even amplified the point more.
How about high school?
When I was 14, I left home, and I went and lived on the street. I've lived under a bridge viaduct, and I've eaten out of a dumpster, and I've lived at a John 316 mission, and I've even lived at a YMCA. So I know what all of that's like, and when I was 14, I then left the street life, and I joined a traveling carnival. And I did that for 2 years. When I was 14, I was traveling the United States alone by myself, and literally I learned a lot of things a 14-year-old boy shouldn't have to learn.
Were you manning one of the carnival booths?
I had two jobs, because carny job, they think of it as a, they wouldn't use the word bifurcated, but it really is a two-pronged approach. There's what happens when you first come to town, and then there's what happens thereafter. And when you first come to town, this is set up, because you literally are traveling by truck. And so you wheel into the area that you're going to be setting up your carnival, and you have to unload everything from the truck, and you set up your rides. Well, everybody in the carnival has a job. They have a task assigned to them, and these guys are pretty good at making sure they get things done well and efficiently. Well, my job was to construct a ride called the bumper cars, and the bumper cars would be those great big cars that look like small Volkswagens run on metal plates on the floor. Well, that ride is the heaviest and the dirtiest ride in the Midway, because the bumper cars are actually heavier than the chairs on the Ferris wheel, because they are just massive, massive pieces of metal. And then the plate that the cars ride on is just that, it's steel plate. There I am, 14 years old, I probably weighed about 65 pounds, and I'm having to lug and trudge these things out of the truck and onto location and assemble them, and kind of like the new guy always gets the worst job. Well, I was the new guy, so I got the worst job, because no matter how you did it, you ended up with grease from one end to the other. I mean, you look like you're doing blackface in an old vaudeville show. You are nasty looking by the time we get down. Well, that was my setup job. And then when the carnival was going full bore, typically we'd be in town anywhere from 3 days to 7 days, my job was to guess people's age and weight. Remember the movie, The Jerk?
Absolutely, yeah.
That was actually my job. I mean, I actually was a guy who would try to guess their age and weight wrong. And they made a big deal out of the movie, and I'm probably the only guy that laughed out loud when all that happened, because it was so classic, where Steve Martin is saying, like, oh, it's a profit deal. Because it was a profit deal. We would try to guess their age and weight wrong, because they were paying us then 50 cents for us to guess their age and weight. And if we guessed it wrong, they won a prize. Well, the prize cost about a nickel. We made 45 cents every time we got it wrong, and they walked away happy.
So every time you wanted to guess it wrong, or maybe you throw in one right one.
There's a big crowd. You have to get one every now and then right so they wouldn't know it was phony. But it really was, from a master marketing point of view, is these townies, the people who won your Kewpie doll or teddy bear or God knows whatever you're giving away in that event, they would then walk the midway of the county fair with that proudly in their arm, causing everybody else to see that they had one, and then would have our little label of where it came from and which booth it was. And everybody just know, well, wow, that's an easy game to win. I'll go up there to win. Well, every time they showed up to win, we made 45 cents.
Do the carnies look at the townies as suckers when they come to town?
A bit of that, but more than anything, I think if you had to sum it all up in one word, there's almost an adversarial attitude. It's kind of like carnies as a class of people, and I hope not a lot of them are listening to this and come and find out where I live. They start out as feeling like they're second-class citizens. So they walk around a bit with a chip on their shoulder, anticipating that the people in town are not going to like them or are going to think ill of them or will disrespect them in some fashion. And, you know, we all know the law of self-fulfillment prophecy principle. You kind of get what you expect. It tends to follow. So there's that, and then when you have that, then the sucker thing is an easy one to get to next. But if you think the other guy already doesn't like you, then it's kind of okay to, if they take advantage of him.
Yeah, you can rationalize it.
Yeah, you begin to rationalize it quickly. And so their theory was very, very mercenary. This is what we do for a living. The more of it we do, the better the living we make. Let's go do a lot of it.
What were you making at that time at 14?
Oh, I was getting sustenance. I mean, they were paying me enough that I could eat.
Just enough to survive?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't one of them. I wasn't one of the family. And usually those are family-run operations. And, I mean, literally from cousins to uncles to second and third generation. You know, if you looked at a 60-member carnival crew, I bet you 40 of them would be blood-connected.
Really? Okay. Did you ever consider going back home? Was there a home for you to go back to with your brothers and sisters?
There was a home to go back to, but it wasn't one I wanted to go back to. And I never didn't want my brothers and sisters, but since we probably became as dysfunctional as our parents were, and I now communicate with my brothers and sisters, but honestly not near as much as other people I know, because for us it would be difficult because it would be fame, something we have to manufacture.
Right. What was the last straw that got you to leave the carnival?
I joined a street gang, and I joined a street gang because I got abused at the carnival. It's one of those things you don't talk about a lot. It just happened. One of those things that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people, and I didn't want that to happen anymore, and I could leave. And so I left, and the only place for me to go, well, it probably wasn't the only place, but the next easy place for me to go was joining a street gang. And I totally understand now in hindsight that whole mentality of what's going on with the youth today and gangs. For me, it was probably the first time I ever belonged to something. You know, it's the first time I ever had any sense of affinity, of comradeship, of kinship, maybe even love or protection. And protection was what I was looking for mostly. Because today, I'm 58 years old, and I'm in pretty good shape. You know, I've gone on to learn how to wrestle and box, and I'm a black belt in karate and a brown belt in judo. Physically, I'm okay. But back then, I was a scrawny little runt, and getting abused is what happens to scrawny little runts. And so my way of getting protection was to join a group of people who would look out for me.
What was the name of the gang?
The name of the gang was the Manor Boys, M-A-N-O-R. And they had taken the name after an abandoned building that they lived in. And there was like 40 of us all together. And at 16, I was the youngest one of the whole crew. And I was a Manor Boy for 2 years. I know that during those 2 years, we broke all the commandments. I mean, I think we got every single one of them. Literally every one of them. I just told you more than most people would want to talk about.
All right. Just tell me the story about how you'd go into a bar and make a bet with the beer.
You have done some research on me, Michael.
Yes, I have.
Congratulations. Most people don't dig that deep. Since I was the smallest one of the bunch, it was my job to go start the fight. I mean, every Friday night and Saturday night, we would fight. I mean, that was what we did. We would drink beer and fight. And not necessarily in that order, because sometimes we'd get them out of order, but that was the only two things we ever did. We fought and we drank. And since I was the skinniest, smallest kid of the group, it was my job to always go start the fight with whomever we were going to start the fight with. Typically, some rival gang across town or in some other town or wherever we happened to be traveling to, and we would travel quite a bit. It would be my job to go provoke it, and the methodology was always the same. Because I was the littlest kid, they would send me in first, and it could be a dance hall, it could be a skating rink, it could be a drive-in theater. It didn't make any difference wherever we were going to start our fight at. They would send me in first, and typically the way it would work, I'd walk in with a long-neck beer bottle in my hand. Because everybody carried long-neck beer bottles, mostly for weapon purposes as much as for drinking purposes. And I'd walk up to the biggest guy in the opposite group, the opposite gang, and I'd literally walk right up to him and stand in front of him, hold the beer bottle out in front of me, between me and him, and before he could even say anything, I would start talking. And my script was pretty rote memory. I'll make you a bet. I'll bet I can drop this bottle and hit you and then you hit the ground before the bottle of beer does. And while he's processing those words in his brain, I let go of the bottle of beer. Now, when you let go of a full bottle of beer held at shoulder height, everybody, I don't care who you are, your eyeballs will follow the bottle of beer. You know that's a glass bottle. It's going to break. Something bad's going to happen. And whether you want to follow it or not, your eyeballs will follow it every single time. And that was my cue. As soon as his eyes went off of me, his brain still processing what it is I just said, and began to follow the bottle of beer falling through the air, that'd be my cue to poke him in the nose. I hit him as hard and as fast as I could. Usually, before the bottle actually hit the ground, I would be making contact with this guy's face. I don't think anybody ever really hit the ground before the bottle hit, but it didn't make any difference. I already got the first poke in. And if you get the first poke in a fight, if you don't win, shame on you.
So would they go down sometimes?
Oh, yeah, because when you hit them by surprise, I mean, you don't have to hit them with a lot. Thank God, they don't have very much. But when you can surprise people and hit them square dab in the middle of the face with a clenched up fist, throwing it as hard as you possibly can, you know, boxers and people who fight for a living, they're ready for the punch. You know, and they're ready to resist it. They're ready to slip it. They're ready to bob. They're ready to weave. They're ready to do something. But they also know the likelihood of getting hits real high, and so subconsciously, if not consciously, they're ready to take a punch almost all the time. But when you've got some guy whose brain is processing some words he didn't quite understand, and his eyeballs are watching something else somewhere else, and all of a sudden he gets smacked out of nowhere, you know, in hindsight, I look back and say, somebody, whoever told me how to do all this, really thought their way through it. Because this is good stuff. I mean, I think you get to use it later in life.
Did you ever get your butt really beat up?
Oh, yeah. Because what would happen immediately thereafter, if you didn't knock him down, or even if you did knock him down, then all of his friends would jump all over you, or he would jump all over you. And my job after throwing the first punch was to get the heck out of the building as fast as I possibly could, because I would always walk in alone. And they would think, the people I was now contesting with, that I was alone. And so they would then chase me out of the building. If I got out of the building, my gang would be waiting outside, and that's when the fight would really start, and we'd have the element of surprise. The people chasing me wouldn't be expecting me to have my group out front, and so we would almost always win because of the element of surprise. The bad news, however, would be if I didn't make it outside the building. If they got me before I got outside the building, I didn't have any help in there. I was all alone, and the beatings would be pretty unmerciful because here you are, you just poked the biggest guy in the opposite gang smack dab in the nose, and if you didn't take him down, or even if you did take him down, the other group is going to be really, really irritated at you. And so they would just pound on you, and by the time I didn't come running out of the building, then my gang, in fact, would come in. But that would be a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Now, that doesn't sound like a very long time. Imagine yourself laying on a floor and somebody kicking on you for a minute or two or three. That's like a really, really long time.
Wow.
Yeah, there were times I got beat up pretty bad.
Now, were you drinking at that time?
Oh, yeah. That's all we did. We drank and we fought, and by the time I was 16, I was an alcoholic. I was drinking a case of beer every night.
But a case every night?
A case of beer every single night. I literally would drink 24 bottles of beer a night.
Wow, that's a lot of beer.
Oh, it's a lot of beer, and I look back at it in hindsight and wonder where in the heck it all went. How do you consume that much liquid? But, you know, in those days, that's all we did. We drank beer and we fought.
For more free reports, products, and services from Bill Bartman, go to www.billionairebubba.com. That's www.billionairebubba.com. So at what point did you realize, hey, I want to get out of this gang, I'm drinking too much? Was that right before you wanted to get into the Marines?
It was about the same time, and I'm not sure which happened first. I think me kind of getting a little older, by the time I was 17, I realized that this wasn't a career, getting beat up and beating up, drinking and doing all kinds of other things. Though it certainly had some excitement to it, it was a dead-end deal, and that was back in 1967, and the Vietnam War was still raging, and I was pretty macho in those days, because, like I said, all I was doing for a living was drinking and fighting. And so joining the U.S. Marine Corps seemed like it'd be a really good idea. I could drink beer with the boys and fight with the boys and do it for God and glory. It made perfect sense to a stupid 17-year-old kid. And so I enlisted, only to find out I got rejected, or was going to get rejected at the medical exam. They said I couldn't hear in my left ear, and I was deaf in my right ear. So today I wear a hearing aid in both, and with them I usually hear about half of what goes on around me. And it turns out I was born with it.
Did you know earlier that he had a hearing problem?
No.
You really had no idea?
I thought everybody heard the little bit that I heard.
Yeah, you couldn't compare it to anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I thought everybody said what for, like, every other word. That was a big piece of my vocabulary.
Right. Okay, so you're rejected by the Marines. How did that affect you?
It devastated me because I had made up my mind that I was going to go do this, that I was going to get in, that I was going to go, and, you know, and I don't know what else was going through my head at that moment, but I knew this was something I really, really wanted to do. So when they told me I had flunked the medical exam, I went back and took the hearing test 3 separate times. I went to 3 different doctors and retook the exam 3 different times because I was convinced they were wrong. I was convinced that my hearing was just fine, thank you very much, and if I could get a doctor to say so, then they would have to let me in. Well, I never could get a doctor to say so, and they never did let me in.
All right, speed me forward. When did you meet your wife?
Well, Kathy and I actually met earlier. We met when I was 14 and she was 11. So during this period of time, from my carny days to some of my gang days to all of my high school dropout days, Kathy was in the circle that would float around me. It'd be like two spaceships in orbit. You know, we would only pass each other every so often. But we began dating, not terribly serious at 14 and 11, but we actually went out on our first date when we were 14 and 11. And we ultimately dated for 10 years. Before we finally got around to getting married, and we have now been married for 33 years.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and Michael, I will tell you, and I don't blink or blush when I say it, I've had some great successes in my life, and I really have. I have had some wonderful, wonderful successes. None of them measure up to the success I've had with Kathy. I mean, this woman is so powerful and so wonderful, and she's not in the room with me as we're talking, so I don't have to say this to suck up to her. This lady transformed me from that which we just talked about, that high school dropout, that drunk, that member of the street gang, that carny, that loser. She transformed me by finding value in me and demonstrating that she thought there was value in me, and because I loved her so much, even at a young age, I believed her. And for the very first time in my whole life, I had to wonder whether I really had value in me. Because heretofore, I'd always knew I did not have value. And all of a sudden, you know, I had to ask the positive side of that question. What if I could do that? What if I tried to do that? What if I want to go do that? Wow. Huh.
You had someone that finally loved you and that believed in you. And sometimes, you know, a force like that, there's no stopping a man or what he can do.
You know, that's why when you asked the question earlier, Kathy was the epiphany. Kathy was the thing that happened. It is now 40-plus years later, and I can tell you exactly where I was and exactly what the event was that caused all this to begin to change. It wasn't one of those things that, you know, transformed you overnight and you're a different person the next morning. It wasn't like that at all. It was one of the very slow evolutionary process. But, I mean, I remember it. I was 17 years old, and she was 14. So this is 3 years after we had initially met, and I was driving her to work. She was a Girl Scout counselor. And on the way to me driving her to work, I was talking as I always do, and she just screams out, "Stop the car! I want out!" And with that, she slaps the dashboard as hard as she can. Now, Kathy is a real quiet, diminutive person. These are things so out of character for her that it's startling. I'm just absolutely stock-raving startling that this lady is doing something weird. So I immediately pull the car over to the gravel side of the road. She gets out, she slams the door, she sticks her head back in through the passenger window and says, "I never want to see you again." And I'm looking like the deer in the headlights going, "My God, what's going on? What is this woman even talking about?" And she continues, she said, "I love you, and I want to spend the rest of my life with you, but I can't stand being around you when you put yourself down." And I looked at her again with that dumb look on my face, and it finally dawned on me that every time I described me, every time I talked about me, every time I processed a sentence, it would be somewhat, you know, we didn't know the words negative affirmation. Some negative affirmation of, well, what do you expect from a guy like me? Or what do you expect from a guy from the wrong side of the railroad tracks? Or what do you expect from a high school dropout? Or what do you expect from an alcoholic? Or what do you expect from a drunk? Or blah, 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 blah. I mean, every time I opened my mouth, I was implicitly and explicitly putting me down. Now, you know, she didn't know the word negative affirmation either, but she knew I was speaking ill of someone she thought value of. And because I loved her and wanted her even at 17, I listened to her and thought, God, if this woman thinks I have some value, maybe I do. Huh. I mean, what an epiphany that was. What a wake-up call. Just to begin to suspect that maybe you had some value.
All right, so when you suspected you did have some value, were you able to stop the negative talk? And were you able to stop drinking? Was that when it started, when you started to believe that you had some value?
All of it happened kind of in a synchronized fashion thereafter, and it wasn't like, oh, my God, it's all going to happen by tomorrow morning. But it began to happen in this order where I quit talking negative about myself because she just got back in the car under the condition that I would never do it again and made me promise that I would not speak negative again. Now, I'm sure I broke that promise once or twice by mistake and then only to be reminded of it and then not do it again. But once you quit talking negative, the opposite starts happening. You know, the lack of a negative is a positive. And so the fact that I was no longer saying negative things about me, I began to actually feel better about me. And that created an environment where Kathy then suggested that maybe I should take the GED test. Now, the general equivalency diploma, I mean, it's for essential high school dropouts. And I had been offered to take it before, but I was afraid to take it. I was afraid I'd fail. But here's this lady telling me that I should take it. And I had then this new confidence that maybe I could pass it. And I went and I passed it. And I think it was probably the first test I've ever passed in my whole life. And I don't think that made me a smart guy, but at least gave me a bit of confidence. And with that, I was able to get into college, albeit on probation. I stayed on probation for 4 years, graduated with a straight C average, 2.000 GPA.
What were you majoring in college?
I majored in sociology and psychology. I actually ended up with a double major, believe it or not. And now in later life, I can't believe how smart that was to pick two social sciences, because that made essentially all my money in the social arena.
How were you supporting yourself during college?
I worked at a meatpacking plant. It was in Dubuque, Iowa, and there was a company called the Dubuque Packing Plant. It, at the time, was the largest independent packing plant in the world. And there was a hog slaughtering operation where they literally would slaughter hogs and turn them into bacon and ham and sausage and et cetera.
Now, weren't you born next to the hog slaughtering plant?
The very same one.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah. It's so amazing, Michael, that I grew up 2.5 blocks away from the place I would go to work when I was 18 years old.
So how long did you work there, and you were able to finance your college?
I did. I was able to finance my college by working there, and I became a union steward for the AFL-CIO while I was working there. So I may be the only union steward that ever became a billionaire.
What's a union steward?
A union steward is a representative of the union. So I was a full-fledged card-carrying member of the AFL-CIO, and our union was Local 150, as Amalgamated Meat Cutters and Butcher Workmen of North America. And as a union steward, I was in charge of all of the employees in my department. I was the union representative. So we had 600 employees in the hog slaughtering piece of the company, and those 600 people then were under my stewardship.
So this is probably foundational stuff for understanding corporate structure and employees in those numbers, right?
Michael, you couldn't have given me a better education. I mean, I was 19 years old, and I had 600 people under me, and I was having to deal with issues with grown men on the other side, you know, company presidents and labor union leaders. And in fact, when I was 20, I called a strike. Because we, 600 people, we were all college kids, and we were essentially part-time workers at this meat plant. And the union, though we were all union members, the union wasn't giving us full-time benefits. In fact, it wasn't giving us any benefits at all, other than that we were union members. We didn't get any vacation, we didn't get any medical, we didn't get any retirement, we didn't get any of that stuff. All that stuff was being reserved for the quote-unquote full-time employees. Well, I thought that was unfair. We're working 20 hours a week because we're all going to college, and we're paying full union dues. We got to be able to get half representation or 50-50 representation. We got to be able to get 50% of what full-time workers are getting, and that just to me was inescapable logic. And they didn't care how inescapable my logic was. They told me not only where to go, but what horse to ride out on. So I called a strike.
Was it successful?
Yeah. I called a strike against the company and the union. I'm the only union steward that's ever done that. And it was a 4-day walkout strike, and we got beat up every day for 4 days. We would be outside picketing, and the full-time guys would come through, and they would just kick the living dickens out of us. And we'd be there the next night doing it again.
What lesson did you learn from that?
The lesson I learned is that when you're right, you don't give up. Just never give up, no matter how bad they're beating on you, no matter how much it hurts. I mean, they threatened to fire my dad. My dad is a janitor at a local school, and the people who owned the meat packing plant were the largest philanthropist in town. I'm not sure I knew what that word was then, but I do now. And they threatened to get my dad fired from a school job. Kathy's dad was president of a paper company that did a lot of business with the packing company. They threatened to terminate the relationships with him.
Did either of those happen?
No. And the death threats literally called into the house and to the local news stations and things of that sort. Plus, we got beat up 4 nights in a row. But when you're right, you're right.
So you stand your ground.
Yeah. You do. You have to.
So how much longer were you with the meatpacking plant, and how did you transition into real estate?
Well, I went to law school first. I left the meatpacking plant to go to law school after I graduated from college. I got into law school.
Why did you want to go to law school?
Probably for a lot of psychological reasons. First, there is always, you know, psychologically the money. When you grow up a poor kid, having money would be cool. And then secondly, I grew up in a neighborhood where there was just a whole bunch of people being disadvantaged by the system. And that was back when Ralph Nader was still Ralph Nader. You know, people who are living today don't know the Ralph Nader of 30 years ago. Ralph Nader of 30 years ago was a champion for the underdog. He was the first guy to really stand up and try to make it right for the poor people. Since then, he's gone off and gone green. And whether you like him or don't, his mission is certainly different than it used to be. So back in those days, I mean, it'd be like, you know, somebody joining the Peace Corps. It was idealistic. Well, I wanted to go be a lawyer to join, as they then called it, Nader's Raiders. I wanted to be one of Ralph Nader's people helping poor people. And that really got me into law school. And the bad news is I flunked out for a semester for summer school and had to spend another whole year figuring out how to get back in so I could ultimately graduate 2.5 years later.
Tell me about the history of the law school never let someone back in after they've been kicked out.
Well, I need to back into my senior year of college. That's when I decided I wanted to go to law school. Now, most smart guys decide that their freshman year of college and take 4 years of preparatory courses. Well, I'm deciding my last semester of my senior year. Well, it's a day late and a load short to do anything about your grade point average, and my grade point average is 2.00. Well, that year, to get admitted, you need a 3.5. So I'm woefully inadequate. And then I take the LSAT, the law school admissions test, and I got a 530. That year, the admission standard was 750. So I am absolutely zero qualified to get into law school, and I sent out 43 applications. I applied to 43 different law schools, and I got 43 rejections. I then found Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, because Drake had a unique program. Drake had a thing called the Summer Conditional Program, and what it was an opportunity for kids like me who might have some capacity to be a good lawyer but didn't have the academics. Because remember, this is back in the Vietnam era, so there's military people coming home, veterans, coming back who had really learned a lot of life experiences but didn't have the academics. And so Drake University had a very enlightened program called the Summer Conditional Program, and they would let 100 kids register for 2 summer school courses, and then at the end of that summer school session, they would take the top 50 and let them enter the next fall. So, I mean, this is wonderful for me. I'm getting an opportunity to prove I can do it. So I signed up, and I couldn't wait to get to Des Moines, Iowa and take it. And I went and went to summer school. And that summer, I got 2 B's in the 2 courses that were required that we all take, these 100 of us. I got 2 B's. And, Michael, I never got a B in high school. I never got a B in college.
So you were excited.
Oh, man, I got 2 B's in law school. You know, I don't think I'm Einstein, but all of a sudden I'm feeling pretty doggone smart, thinking, wow, you know, maybe I'm a late bloomer.
Getting a little confidence under your belt.
Yeah, and then I got a letter from Drake University telling me I was number 51, and they only let the top 50 in. So I essentially flunked out. So I went back to the dean, his name was Robert Hayes, and I said, Dean Hayes, you got to let me back in, man. I'm number 51. I was so close I could smell it. And he said, they got 2 B's and never had a B, etc. And I told him my whole life story, tried to get him to feel sorry for me, and he didn't. He said, hey, in 125-year history of Drake University, we've never let anybody in the second time, and we're not going to start now. So some people thought that was then impossible to get back in, but it wasn't. I figured out a way to kind of work the system, so to speak, and I was able to get back in the following summer and managed to stay in.
How'd you do it? What was your idea?
It was one of those fluky things. You couldn't have conspired this. I mean, you couldn't sit down and say, okay, let me see how I'm going to do this. Being a street kid, I think, was my advantage. As a street kid, you learn to see opportunity quickly because you need to see things always in a very quick fashion. You need to see positives or negatives real quick and know the difference, because if you don't, you're going to get run over with something. I found out that there was a fellow in my neighborhood, my not very good neighborhood, Dubuque, Iowa, who was about to run for Congress as a Republican. Well, Dubuque, Iowa was 90% Catholic and 100% Democrat. He's just never elected a Republican, ever. So this guy is fresh meat. He is not going to win. He knows it, but he's a token candidate, as you would use that expression. And I didn't know the guy. His name was Ted Ellsworth, but I found out that he had a daughter, and his daughter's name was Kitty, and Kitty was dating a fellow by the name of Tom Stoner. Tom Stoner happened to be the campaign chairman for then the governor of Iowa, a fellow by the name of Robert T. Ray. And Robert Ray was a graduate of Drake University, and he and his wife Billy were on the board of trustees of the law school. So I connected all those dots and said, wow, here's a guy that's going to run for office, going to get his butt kicked. Here's a guy that's got a daughter that's dating a guy that is connected to the governor, and the governor's connected to the school I want to get back into. Gee, I think I need to go talk to this guy. So I went, found him out, and introduced myself to him, never met him before in my life. Walked in and said, hi, this is who I am, and here's my story. Told him about flunking out of law school, and I said, here's what I'll do. Mr. Ellsworth, if you'll let me work for you for the next 5.5 months, I need $60 a week, and I will give you my heart and my soul. I'll work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I'll do any job you want me to do, any time, any place, anywhere. I'll do anything, period. But I need $60 a week to live on, and I want one favor. When the election's over, win, lose, or draw, I want you to introduce me to Tom Stoner under the condition that I get a 5-minute meeting with him. That's all I want, a 5-minute meeting. You give me a 5-minute meeting, and I'll give you the next 5 months of my life. Well, he laughed. What a stupid deal this is for me, what a great deal it is for him. And naturally, he said yes. So we worked our rump off for the next 5 months, and sure enough, he lost. But the morning after the election, he introduced me to Tom Stoner via telephone. I set up a meeting to go visit with Mr. Stoner, and the meeting was set up for the following week. And before that meeting could even transpire, I received a letter from Drake University allowing me to come back into the summer conditional program the next summer.
Good job. You took care of it.
Yeah.
So sometimes it is who you know.
You know, it can be. But it's also recognizing opportunities. You know, the old thing of, you know, not what you know, but who you know. But it's sometimes who knows you and what they know about you.
Well, you acted on an opportunity. Most people would have quit and just taken that letter as face value and never tried anything different because they didn't have the confidence. They would have never tried and made an effort, and they would have lost right there. But you went one step ahead.
Well, and I think that is so much the only difference between me and probably everybody else, and I don't mean it that way. I know egotistically or immodestly, but it is why I got to 9 zeros. It's why I have a permanent place in the Smithsonian. It's why I've won all of the awards I've ever won. It's why everything has happened. I believe I can. I absolutely believe I can. I have enough confidence in me that no matter what the challenge, no matter what the obstacle, no matter what the odds, no matter what the statistics, no matter who's telling me no, that doesn't matter if I believe I can. And when I believe I can, that's the only tool I need in my toolbox to get me from where I'm at to where I want to go. And it works every single swing in time.
That's great. Okay, so did you graduate law school?
Yeah, I graduated in 1975.
Did you become a lawyer?
I did. I practiced law for 5 years and made a lot of money. I was very successful as a lawyer.
What kind of attorney were you?
Mostly I did criminal work. And again, as part of my background, growing up on the streets, you live in a seemly side of life. Well, I recognized it well and understood it thoroughly and could relate to those people completely and knew that not all of them were guilty. Most of them were, honestly.
But, so you were a criminal defense attorney?
Yes. And I just really, really did well financially, and I made a ton of money. But the bad news is I got to a point in my life because I was hanging around with so many, I don't call them seedy people, but, you know, less than good people, that I got to where I didn't like me, I didn't like Kathy, I didn't like my kids, I didn't like anything. You know, that old adage of you become the 5 people you hang out with.
Yeah, how old were your kids at that time?
Oh, my kids were just children. I mean, literally 3 and 5.
So you're making money, but you just weren't happy.
Absolutely. I was making a lot of money, but becoming unhappier by the moment. And I looked at Kathy one day and I said, I want to quit. I want to turn my shingle around backwards, and I don't want to practice law anymore. So we marked the date, and the date we picked was our 5th anniversary of the day I started practicing, January 20, 1980. Which is 5 years after January 20, 1975, and we turned the shingle around backwards, and we moved to Oklahoma.
And then you went into real estate?
Actually, I'd been in real estate for the last year when I knew I was going to retire. We started investing heavy in real estate, and then we got very heavy in real estate and started buying a lot of commercial buildings, a lot of apartment buildings, a lot of single-family houses, duplexes, fourplexes, and just about anything that had real estate in it. We would experiment with it because this was back in the early 80s, and if you remember, the real estate market went to hell in a handbasket in the late 70s. In the early 80s, it was still on its rump, but what a great time to buy.
So were you a millionaire at that time?
Yes. Yeah, I retired from law as a millionaire.
A few times over? A
couple times over.
So how did we get to Hawkeye Pipe Services? Describe what that business is. What services you provide?
It was an oil country tubular goods business. In other words, we manufactured pipe. We created the pipe that goes inside an oil well. So when you drill a hole in the ground, you're literally boring a hole through the earth, and then you have to put a pipe inside that hole to keep the rock and the dirt from filling the hole back up.
How did you get into it?
The bank came to me. I was living down in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and my bank came to me, and they had a business that was in the pipe business that they had financed that was doing poorly. And they asked me if I would go in and spend 30 days just looking it over to advise them on how to liquidate it, because they were going to have to do a foreclosure against the individual who was the present owner. So it wasn't a good duty, but it was a duty that they asked me to do, and I like doing favors for banks. So I said, sure. So I went in, and I spent 30 days, and I came back and gave my report. My report was quite opposite of what they thought it was going to be. I said, really, you shouldn't be liquidating it. You should be putting more money into it. I said, there's a good business here. There's a great business here. There's a business here that can really make enough money to retire all the debt it's ever had and make somebody a small fortune if you'll do things remarkably different than the individual who's presently running the company. They then sat down with the person who was running the company, and instead of a foreclosure, they worked out a buyout agreement. But the bank actually bought him out of the business he was in. And then they just literally transferred it over to me. Let me sign on the note, so I actually end up buying it from the bank. And then they agreed to finance the additional capital that it was going to take to get the business up and running the way it should get up and running. And within the first year, we got up to $1 million a month revenue business.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. What was the one key that the business wasn't doing? Where was the opportunity that you spotted during that 30 days?
There were two things. and they're so basic, customers and employees. This guy was really good at manufacturing. He knew manufacturing in and out and up and down, back and forth, and he knew everything there was about how to make pipe. He didn't know come here from Sikkim about his employees, and therefore he had bad employees. He had lousy employees. He had terrible employees because you get what you give. And he was being bad to them, and they were being bad right back. They were stealing stuff right and left. They were breaking things on purpose. They were not showing up on time and leaving early. Well, how do you run a railroad if that's the kind of employees you have? And then his customers. He didn't appreciate a customer. He thought it was a transaction-based business where he sells them something, they write a check, and end the program. And in sales, it's never transactional. It's relationship. You know, you need to, you know, I don't say suck up in a bad way, but you need to curry favor with your customers. You need to follow up after the sale. You need to stay in a relationship with them. Even if they never buy another product from you, and some of them were not going to ever buy another product because they only needed one, they would tell people. They are in the industry. They have lunch with other prospective customers. They have breakfast with other prospective customers. They play golf with other prospective customers. And the way you treat them is the way they will tell other people about you. So he did two things terribly, terribly wrong. He didn't take care of his employees. He didn't take care of his customers.
You were able to turn it around and got it doing, what, $1 million a month?
$1 million a month, yeah. It had been doing about $40,000 a month. I mean, it had been just struggling to pay the rent.
Wow. And how long did that take to get it up to $1 million a month?
1 year.
1 year. So how long did you stay with that business until the lights went out?
We stayed there for 3 years, continued to run that business and grow it, and we're in the middle of actually doing a major acquisition, a Wall Street acquisition, General Electric Capital Corporation, and just agreed to lend me $25 million to go buy an upline pipe manufacturer, somebody whom we were buying a lot of materials from. And that's when, if you remember a thing called OPEC, today when we hear the price of oil, we cringe. Well, back then the price of oil was going the other direction. Oil then, in the late 80s, 1986, was $40 a barrel. And literally within one afternoon, it went from $40 a barrel down to $14 a barrel.
Wow.
Well, when oil drops that precipitously that quick, everybody who was drilling an oil well stops because there's no point. And if they're not going to finish the drilling the well or not start drilling a new one, they don't need what I'm selling.
Did you know it was over that day?
We knew it was over that day, and 30 days later, it became fait accompli.
Had you done any planning anticipating something like this?
I don't know in hindsight that we could. I mean, now when I talk to my students and I give a lot of business lessons, I talk to them about political risk. I don't know what I could have done to stop somebody from OPEC from turning the valve the other direction, but I didn't even know there was a political risk involved. I didn't even know that was one of the possibilities. And had I at least known that was a possibility, then I might have gone to rule number 3 that we talked about earlier, where always diversify your financial holdings. I had not. All of my eggs were in one basket.
Give the listeners one or two ideas for where you could have had some of your other money that could have kept it safe from the fail of the business.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so obvious in hindsight for me, I'm a guy that made a lot of money in real estate. But when I got in the oil and gas side of life, I liquidated all of my real estate holdings and moved all that money into my oil and gas business. Because that's where I was paying all my attention. That's where I was spending my 8-hour a day, actually probably 12-hour a day life. If I had been smarter, I would have diversified and kept some of the money in something else I knew something about, which in my case would have been real estate. So even though I would have gone broke in the oil and gas business, and that oil and gas business might have gone belly up and quit and not continued operations, and as bad as that might have been, I personally still would have had some money left over. Would have had some assets left over that weren't included in the collapse of the oil and gas company.
All right, when you took over that business, you personally signed for the liability of that company?
Yes. And when you're starting a new business and you're unproven in an industry, that's relatively the norm. That's relatively common, and you know, if you can talk your way out of it or negotiate your way out of it, that's great. But most people can't early in their life. Now, later in my life, I was able to negotiate $3.1 billion worth of loans, all of them non-recourse. Not just not personal guaranteed, non-recourse.
Okay, so 30 days later, basically the company was gone.
Yeah, 30 days later, literally the company had imploded. We did it peacefully and voluntarily with the bank. The very bank that helped me get in the business was still my banker, and I went to them when I saw prices going from 40 to 14 and said, hey guys, we're both in trouble. Let's do this gracefully and diplomatically and with dignity and respect, and let's try to make this work as good as we possibly can for both of us. You need to get repaid, and I certainly want to have a life when I'm done. And we worked together, the bank and I, for the next 30 days, and we liquidated everything. We liquidated the building, the facilities, the furniture, the fixtures, the equipment, all of the stuff And when they were done doing the tally, I was $1 million in the hole.
Now, you talk about in Inc. magazine, your friends abandoned you, your so-called friends.
Yeah. You know, when you're rich and famous and you're riding high and life is good and your billfold is fat and you can buy everybody dinner and take them to nice places, it's amazing how many people you have around you who call themselves your friend and, quite frankly, who naively we think of as our friend. And again, I'm not a bitter person. I'm trying to say this in a harsh or unkind way, but mostly that's a misperception by us that these people are nice people, and they're good people, and they're kind people, and we should love them, but we should never confuse them with who they really are at the end of the day. At the end of the day, they are people who need and want to be able to deal with their own concerns, not your concerns, which goes to rule number two. And so when, as I said, the crap hit the fan, all these people who I thought were my friends vanished. They were like smoke on a windy day. You know, it's still metaphysically still smoke, and it's metaphysically still there. You just can't see it anymore. It's poof. It's gone.
Was it hard for you and Kathy?
The hardest thing we had then ever suffered, because we naively believed that these people really were our friends and that they would stick with us through, as the saying goes, thick and thin, not just the thick part. And there were people whom we had spent a lot of time with, had great relationships with, and thought, again, naively, we really had a wonderful relationship, only to find out they would cross the street to avoid running into us if they were to see us coming down the street.
So you had an opportunity to go bankrupt, but you chose not to. Why?
Well, it was more than an opportunity not to. One of our creditors was the very company I mentioned previously that we were trying to do an acquisition. One of the companies that we were trying to do the acquisition on was, in fact, one of our creditors because of somebody we'd been doing business with. And they then sued for an involuntary bankruptcy. They sued to put me in bankruptcy.
What was the advantage of them doing that?
So that I couldn't acquire them. They were afraid that even though they didn't want me to do the acquisition, by the way, because they were afraid they would then lose their job if I acquired them, management would get replaced by my management team. And quite frankly, they're probably right.
Could you have acquired them still if you did not file bankruptcy?
Yes. If the bankruptcy cloud hadn't been on me, but they were smart, they really were. You know, always respect a good adversary, and these people were good adversaries. By suing me in involuntary bankruptcy, even though I ultimately won and was not declared bankrupt, it took me 3 years to do that. I had to go all the way through the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver to prove that I wasn't a person that should be declared bankrupt. Well, because it took me 3 years and essentially all of my finances that I had left, which wasn't that many, and all of my effort, my energy, well, I didn't have any time or money to go acquire anybody.
Were you handling all the legal stuff yourself?
No. No, I had a lawyer who was actually doing the courtroom side. I did all the research. I did all of the preparation. I did all the brief writing. I did all of the material handling. I did 99% of it. The only thing I didn't do was stand up in a courtroom because I shouldn't.
So for 3 years, what were you doing? If the company wasn't making money, what was going on during those 3 years?
Those 3 years, I was in my law firm's law library doing nothing but research. I was making sure I didn't lose. Because it was the most important thing to me at that moment in my life. I did not want to be in a bankruptcy. You know, not just a kid growing up on the wrong side of the railroad tracks. After a while, you get a little bit of pride in you. It's real hard to get that pride back out of you.
Please continue to part two. You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.